Are you ready for a true ghost story? It starts in Kansas City back in the early 1900s. Thomas Swope was a really big deal back then. He was a multimillionaire here in town, and he had given land to the city for a massive park, Swope Park. You're probably familiar. When Thomas Swope died under circumstances you'd call suspicious, at the very least, his body was laid in state at the library, which seems weird. And then they built a proper memorial in Swope Park. It's guarded by two stone lions that you can still see today. But that is not where the ghost story takes place. The really weird stuff that's happened was in Swope's mansion, which was sold to the RLDS Church in Independence in 1923. It was later taken over by the City of Independence for offices and stuff.
All the while, stories persisted about ghosts and strange happenings. Staff members had reported hearing footsteps throughout the house. Doors opened and closed on their own. Colonel Swope's office seemed to have been the most active, with stories of papers flying about and books being tossed onto the floor. Some even saw ghosts floating through the upper rooms and hallways. The house was eventually abandoned, and it was destroyed in 1960. Today, you'd never know where it once stood, since it has become a quaint neighborhood in the years since.
That's the voice of Darren Hinesley. He's the host of a podcast called Creepy in KC, where he tells stories like this. In honor of Halloween, we're kicking off our Audiophiles show recommending great new podcasts with some of Darren's favorite creepy tales from Kansas City's past. I'm Gina Kaufman. Darren Hinesley, welcome to KCUR's Central Standard.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
That is pretty creepy about the Swope Mansion.
Yeah. At the time, it was national news. It was in all the papers. People followed that story.
The story of his death, you're talking
about. His and 10 family members.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so for people who do not know the circumstances right. around all of those deaths, what's the basic story there?
That he was poisoned by it was alleged to have been poisoned by a person known as Dr. Hyde at the time.
A doctor who stood to gain an inheritance, right?
Yeah, he was married into the family. And so it's believed that he was going to just knock off one family member after the other until him and his wife were left.
Yeah. Okay, so have you talked to people who worked in the mansion when it was used for offices? Where did you find the story about that haunting piece of it?
Just reading the accounts in the newspapers later, that Independence, I believe it's the Independence Examiner, had a series in the 70s that was just talking about the haunted house, and it was for Halloween, matter of fact. And so they had mentioned about the stories, but I don't believe anyone that's still connected to that has survived.
So maybe we'll have to be haunted by them
right.
in order to find out how they were haunted by him.
There you go. Yeah.
Your own story is pretty fascinating. Your family has experienced some hauntings, right?
Oh, that was how I was raised, was hearing all the family ghost stories.
Tell me about that.
Well, like the main one was that my great-grandfather was murdered in northern Arkansas. He was shot by a drunkard who he had thrown out of his general store that he had owned. And so his ghost is supposed to have continued to haunt the family farm down there.
What was the nature of that haunting?
It's, as I mentioned in one of my podcasts, it was the classic black hat shadow person. My mother saw this shadowy figure in the night, and that's been seen by many people over the decades.
What do you personally do with this kind of story? I mean, do you full-fledged believe in ghosts?
I want to believe. I've certainly heard things that I have difficulty explaining. I like to say that probably 90% of the supposed hauntings can be explained away, so it's that 10% or so that I'm most interested in.
So what inspired you to look into specifically the creepy side of Kansas City and then to like build that into a podcast?
Just living here and hearing these stories. And I seem to have been the go-to guy at a Halloween party or something who could tell a ghost story or could scare people with something that I had found out.
I'm also intrigued by your background working for the Kansas City Police Department and the Records Department and the Crime Lab. Does that inform your perspective at all?
Well, it sort of validates it in many ways because I was able to go back and look at these old case files and could see where, like, for instance, I had always heard about these stories in the Elmwood Cemetery having a haunting. And it seemed like a legend until I saw the actual police report where this man had been found committing suicide there.
I think that we may have a little bit of audio from the podcast where you dig into that. So let's talk about it. But I want to start off with Elmwood Cemetery itself. Before we get into that story, the location, you said you had always heard about it.
Yeah. Well, it's a very historic, it's a beautiful cemetery. And so it seemed just a natural place to wonder about. I'm one of those people that I don't find cemeteries scary. I find them very peaceful. I've had many a lunch just sitting in that place and along the mausoleum row that they call there. So it was just being friends with the caretakers there and that I learned these
What do
legends.
You like about lunching in the cemetery on Mausoleum Row?
I know. Well, cemeteries at the time, and we have some great ones here, Union Cemetery in downtown and especially Mount Washington Cemetery in Independence. They were designed at the time to be like parks. They were meant for people to go there and to stroll and just find peace. So they weren't really scary places.
And we've made them that?
I like to continue. Yeah, they're scary at times, especially when they find out that there's been a tragedy there.
Well, so this story is about someone cremated at the Elmwood Cemetery a long, long time ago. The story is set in summertime, so use your imagination.
Before the midday heat had peaked on July the 2nd, a middle-aged man walked into the offices of Elmwood Cemetery. He was dressed in a threadbare gray suit and asked to pay for a cremation, his own. He said that he had saved the money for the services, $50, but feared losing it. He also requested that his ashes be scattered in the cemetery. He said his name was John W. Shaw and that no one would be mourning him. The money was exchanged, he was given a simple receipt, and was assured that everything would be arranged. 2 days later, on July the 4th, 1936, once again the temperature soared past 100 degrees. Just northwest of the stone chapel within the grounds of Elmwood Cemetery, beside the road, a broad maple tree shaded a cluster of graves and stone monuments. Just before 4 p.m., a caretaker was startled to find a man hanging motionless from a wide, outstretched limb. A receipt was found in his coat pocket. It was the $50 receipt made out to John W. Shaw.
That really freaks me out, Darren Hinesley. I do not love being freaked out, I will add. It's a very disturbing story.
Yes. And it would have just disappeared had it not been for that police report. So it was just reading those details came from that report with some dramatic license. I'm a bit of a writer myself, so I could add a little bit to it. But basically the facts are, that this mysterious man unfortunately hung himself in the cemetery. And that has always been that's been one of the persistent legends there is to see this ghostly man near that chapel.
What are some of the other Elmwood Cemetery legends?
Well, I've been skeptical about why would a cemetery be haunted in the first place, because most of the people that are interred there never were there when they were alive.
Yeah, you think if they're going to bother rising or whatever, they'd go somewhere else.
Right. I think most of it just has to do with just being at a cemetery and at night or in the evening, that is a natural place for the imagination to turn to ghosts and spirits.
These are historic hauntings, but, you know, as you've mentioned, most of us know people who are convinced that a place they hang out in or live is haunted. Can you tell me about a less famous local haunting that really stands out in your mind?
Well, one that I'm curious about that I used to hear some when I was a boy, at 1425 Grand, which is near the Sprint Center now. That used to be where a Union prison, Civil War prisoner camp was, that collapsed and killed five women. And one of those women was the sister of Bloody Bill Anderson, who led the raid and massacre on Lawrence. So there's a marker that shows where that prison was. And I remember at times talking to people down there before the Sprint Center was built, that they would see ghosts of like Civil War soldiers around those buildings there. And so I'm kind of curious now. I wonder if anyone in the Sprint Center has ever noticed any ghosts there.
Ooh, so. Well, people will have to tweet us. We're at KCURCST. If you're a Sprint Center employee or frequenter and you've seen a ghost, you got to let us know. I understand that you have only heard ghosts, never seen them.
Right. I think so. You know, there's always that chance of noticing something out of the corner of the eyes when you walk into a room or something like that. But it's been recording and hearing disembodied voices that's really hard to explain that I've been fascinated with.
But so what do they sound like?
Most of the time it's questioning. It almost seems like that... I've heard things like one recording saying, "Do you still love me?" A female voice just questioning that in the distance that was really chilling. And something like, you know, "Who's there? I can't see you." Just little short things like that. So
don't love being freaked out. Yeah. Did I mention that? Before we go, one last story from your podcast, Creepy in KC. This is from an episode about Webb Castle. It's an Independence, right. And its reputation for being haunted might owe to the fact that there aren't a whole lot of castles in Missouri, which lends this place sort of a mystique. But the story behind it, if I may, is that a farmer-turned-millionaire from Ohio, a guy by the name of Matt Webb, wanted to impress his new bride.
Even though he owned a grand mansion on Linwood Boulevard, he wanted something truly amazing to impress his young bride-to-be, Frances Wiley. After World War I had decimated Europe and Germany, money and investments there were eagerly sought. It was then that Mr. Webb found that there was a price for just about anything. Along the Rhine River, he found an ancient castle that he thought should become a fairy tale home for his new bride. There was just one problem, getting it to Independence. He had it dismantled and every stone numbered and transported piece by piece to America. Webb Castle was reassembled on a wooded hill along what would much later become Truman Road in Independence, Missouri.
So, Darren Hinesley, is the place haunted or what?
Well, unfortunately, it's not there anymore. It's just a hill, and I think it's a cell phone tower. But at the time...
So static.
Right. I saw the ruins of the place. The story goes that it had 13 rooms, huge rooms, and that every room was round. So it had a strange reputation, and it later became the Independence JCs used it as a haunted house, and it was the perfect location for a commercial haunted house.
But the hill does not feel haunted to you?
Well, I think so, but again, it's now private property. The city had the place demolished, but it's just a beautiful location. You can look into that area across from where the cemetery is, and you can see where the lake was. And there's still in antique stores, you can find a postcard occasionally that shows Webb Castle from the 1900s or so. And you can see that little pond in the front with the swans on it.
You know, Do you get the feeling that the world could say is divided into two camps on the whole ghost thing? Not just believing or not believing, but like wanting to see a ghost and not wanting to see a ghost.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Because there's people like you who just don't want to be creeped
out.
No,
not interested.
And when I'm often asked, you know, what's the creepiest, spookiest place in Kansas City? There's lots of known places. But I think that your own homes could be, because this is a historic place. So for this Halloween, I say turn the lights off, light a candle, and ask if there's anyone there with you.
How would you advise that people frame this in their own minds in order to really embrace the experience and not just be like, ah?
Right. I just can't believe that that if a spirit still is roaming here, that it's got evil intentions. I think that it may be lost, that it needs help. So that's the way you should approach it. I don't believe
channel
that
your inner empath.
Yeah, I don't believe that these are demons or anything like that. Although that's another realm. But I think that just they don't want to be alone anymore. So welcome them. And
Darren Hinesley, thank you so much. That's a very kind way of thinking about ghosts.
Well, thank you very much.
Darren's podcast is Creepy in KC. In just a minute, KCUR's Central Standard continues with the audio files. Voracious podcast listeners recommending their favorite listens. I'm Gina Kaufman. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. And now the audiophiles are here to recommend their favorite recent listens. To participate in this conversation, call 816-235-2888 or tweet us at KCURCST. If something you've gotten into deserves a shout out, we want to hear from you. Here in the studio, we're joined by KCUR's Maddie Fox and Mike Russo. They are today's panel on the Audiophile Show. Hi, guys.
Hey, Gina.
Hey, Gina.
So before we jump in, identify your overall podcast listening style, like the kinds of things you like and don't like, et cetera, so that everyone out there can evaluate your recommendations accordingly. Maddie?
Oh, man. I like a lot of sort of storytelling and highly produced podcasts, so lots of different elements, lots of interviews. I mean, being a reporter, I have a little bit of a bias towards reported stories, but I like good production value. And so I listen to some true crime. I listen to some like historical podcasts and a few talk show type things, but not a ton.
I understand. Mike, what about you?
I'd say my style of podcast is probably comedy nerd in some like vein of that, horror or something like that. Big fan of My Fellow Kansans, though.
Oh, thank you.
From the Kansas News Service. Well, okay, Mike, I want to start with you. You're recommending something called Adventures in New America. Tell us about the series overall.
Yeah, so Adventures in New America caught my eye from a New York Times piece that claimed that this social thriller could not let them go. And it is a radio drama, a true radio drama form in the Night Vale Presents category of kind of podcast. And I think the article and my kind of critique as well is saying that radio drama is a form of podcast that never really evolved. It sounds like War of the Worlds, some things you might hear on Prairie Home Companion or like The Shadow or something like that. And that listening experience is somewhat difficult. But Adventures in New America,
like for today's listeners.
Right. It just didn't seem like it transcended or grew with like the media. But this podcast is an Afrofuturism podcast and like does all of the things right to kind of make it accessible and like really riveting in a lot of ways.
So when you say Afrofuturist, what do you mean by that?
I think that's a tough term, a tough genre to kind of like pin down, but it's essentially in this idea of where black people are in a future world of some type of like power or sci-fi thing. Think kind of like Black Panther is like kind of like the very watered down version of it, but there's lots of other versions of that. This podcast kind of feels a little bit like Get Out, Jordan Peele's Get Out. But the key thing, I think the through line for this is that there is, what are they called? Zombie vampires.
Okay. And what, before we start, I also need you to kind of explain who the two main characters are. And
yes.
Then we'll listen to a little clip.
Totally. The two main characters are IA, an overweight mixed race person who has a chronic, he will die of a disease and can't get health care, so he needs to get arrested in this new future world. And his counterpart is a lady.
Sounds like a charming future world.
Right, exactly. A world I want to live in. And his counterpart is named Simon. And Simon is described in the intro as like a psychopath. And they essentially perform heists together to try to maybe get him in jail.
Okay, let's listen to this.
Hello, and welcome to Act 2 of tonight's episode of Adventures in New America. IA and Simon Carr have just met and escaped the law together for the first time. IA wants to go home, but Simon Carr has convinced him to tarry in a poke bowl restaurant.
Okay, I don't know how you did it, but all I know is I am not under arrest, so cheers. You saved my life back there.
That's not my fault. I was trying to get arrested.
How's that?
I've tried everything. I've stolen, I've rode a motorized bike on the subway, and when I do get caught, nothing comes of it.
That's why lunch is on me. I'm hanging with you for the rest of my life. You my good luck charm. The only black man in America who can't get arrested. My name is Simon. Simon Carr. Your friendly neighborhood sociable sociopath. Shake on it, Whitey.
Whitey? What are you talking about? I'm not white, I'm black.
So, Mike, what do you love about this podcast, Adventures in America?
I love that on the scale of, like, political thriller, it is not afraid to tip into, like, all types of politics stuff, but it's also at the heart of it a sci-fi dystopian future with zombie vampires.
What do you think that the zombie vampires represent here? I mean, it's a little confusing that she seems to not either not know he's black or call him Whitey for...
So yeah, the relationship between the two main characters deals with a lot of gender identity and race identity. And IA is he has a white parent and a black parent, and so there's a lot of discussion about like which world he fits into the white world or the black world of the new America. And that just happens through his taxi rides, through when he tries to get arrested and things like that. These recurring characters of zombie vampires are racist. They're unabashedly racist, but they also don't like being called the names that the media are giving them. In fact, they call those names politically incorrect. I think the metaphor for them might be that they're white nationalists. There seems to be a lot of metaphors in this story. But I think that my kind of like thesis is that it's just also a good story if you don't want to deal with the politics as well. It's a fun Halloween romp.
Adventures in New America from Night Vale, being recommended by KCUR's Mike Russo. Now, Maddie Fox, you are also recommending a radio drama. This one's called Deadly Manners. So you're kind of sticking with the Halloween theme?
Yes, I am. So this one is a podcast. If you've ever seen the 1985 movie Clue, based on the board game, which is a personal favorite, it's kind of like that movie, but in a radio drama. It's got... Kristen Bell of The Good Place and Frozen fame doing as one of the main characters. And so it's all these people gathered at a dinner party and then stuff starts to go wrong.
Yeah, it sounds like so when the scene we're about to hear begins, there's a storm outside. People are enjoying cocktails and hors d'oeuvres and the electricity starts to flicker. The host of the party goes to find candles and then.
The power went out completely.
Where's the light?
This isn't good. Turn the power back on.
And then...
What was that sound?
Was that a gunshot?
Couldn't be.
When the lights came on, a shriek was heard from a nearby room. In the billiards room, everyone found an astonished Veronica standing over the dead, bleeding body of the formerly fabulous Enrique Ensemble.
Maddie Fox, tell us more. What do you love about it?
Well, as you might have noticed, it's narrated by LeVar Burton, most recently of LeVar Burton Reads, but, you know, I grew up watching him on Reading Rainbow. So that's a huge plus. The acting is good. I mean, it's a little campy as radio dramas can tend to be. It feels a little overacted sometimes, but, you know, it's fun. It's well sound designed enough that you can sort of get lost in the story. And it is quite an interesting and twisty story. So it was a fun. I binge listened to it one weekend and it was a good But I caught onto it when there were still about 3 episodes left in the season, and so I got stuck on the cliffhangers, and that was really fun. It keeps you engaged.
How do you? I'm curious. Different people have different podcast listening habits, and this doesn't seem like a run on the treadmill and listen kind of thing.
No, I'm a folding laundry while listening to podcast type person, or like doing dishes. I like carry my phone around, and sometimes if I'm not too lazy, I carry around like a Bluetooth speaker and listen to podcasts while I'm doing chores and stuff.
I feel like with those loud crashing sounds, I'd like drop a dish.
Oh yeah. Well, I can't listen to stuff like that when I'm driving because like it's I'm just like if I get
yeah,
too startled, yeah, I don't want to jerk off the road. But yeah.
Well, that's a recommendation for Deadly Manners, inspired by Clue. A podcast being recommended by Maddie Fox of the Kansas News Service. Mike, let's talk about Here Be Monsters. And the episode you've brought in is called Breathholder. We'll talk about the episode itself in just a second. But what is Here Be Monsters?
Here Be Monsters is is produced out of KCRW by Jeff Impfin. And he is a producer that produces a sonically rich podcast about the unknown or the fear of the unknown. There's about 20 episodes each season. It's been going on for a while. And he explores all kinds of different things that might be fearful to somebody. In fact, the inspiration for his first episode was he saw a picture of a placenta that a woman was going to eat after her birth, and he thought that that was very fear evocative to him, so he did a whole episode on that. And that's the type of, like, he goes different places with fear and the unknown and all of
and
his different
nonfiction.
Podcasts. Yes. Yep. If you're familiar with the podcast Love and Radio, it sounds exactly the same. In fact, he's been featured on there before, but this is all about fear and the unknown.
Well, the episode you have brought in is called Breathholder. It's about a guy who goes diving deep underwater, but like without scuba gear or anything.
Mm-hmm. He's a free diver.
Well, let's listen to that.
Sometimes I'll go down to like a rocky bottom at 40 feet and I'll just drift with the current as if I'm dead, right? My arms out and kind of in front of me and my knees relax, my thighs relax, and I'll kind of bump slowly over rocks and I'll feel my fins hitting things, but I'm hardly even moving my eyes, just looking straight ahead with a soft focus, watching the world kind of go by the window of my reality, my mask. Just absolutely dead. I can feel my heart beating, but it's beating slowly. There's something different. There's this wonderful slowness to it all.
That is creepy. That I feel that physically when he's describing that, whatever they're doing with the sound there, it makes you feel it.
This episode made me at times feel like my lungs were going to explode just by listening to it. And I think that that's what this podcast does. He has a famous episode that was maybe not great for the airwaves here, but I can at least mention it. It's called 601 to Satan, and it is about a real hotline of a Satanist that will take prayers for you in Olympia, and he explores all of the haunting nature that that could be as well. So he really goes everywhere with his podcast.
That sounds very cool. So this, again, is called Here Be Monsters.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we have some more podcasts to talk about. We're done listening to them, but I want to kind of do a speed round of some other things that you guys would recommend. And Maddie, Limetown has been around for a while, but you are recommending a new season that's starting.
That's right. Yeah, Limetown wrapped up in December of 2015, so it's been almost 3 years since it was, you know, on the air or on the podcast feed. But they just dropped episode 1 of season 2, I think yesterday. And it's another fictional story about actually a radio reporter who's trying to figure out what happened to this town full of people that vanished. And so season at the end, never mind, spoilers. But so season 2 kind of picks up where season 1 left off 3 years ago. But they've got a couple recaps in the feed so you can catch up if you want.
And same town, same story?
Yes, same story. Yeah.
Ooh, okay. So that's Limetown. And then Mike, what is Adventure Zone?
Oh, cool. Adventure Zone made the list. So my brother and me started a podcast with their dad where they do a D&D, a Dungeon and Dragons campaign. And so they literally go through the campaign with their father and let the story unfold as if you were playing a role-playing game. So it's comedy, and it's also a fantasy story with monsters.
What do you like about it?
Well, I like D&D, so I'm kind of in the target market for it. But I think that outside of that, you kind of get the sense that all true good stories come out of a sense of like a role-playing dynamic. And so it becomes a good, heartwarming and funny story as you just see these made-up characters play. And I also like that their dad is in it. And so it's like a family story.
Can you explain what you mean by that a little more? Like the good stories come out of a role-playing idea, I guess I'd say?
Yeah, so I think that originally D&D was thought of to be the cornerstone for all video game design, that it was like dice rolling and chance and things like that. But then it's also used as a way to just to devise stories and fantasy stories. And I think that it's
like
held
what
up.
What would a character do?
Exactly.
Now.
Yep. Yeah. Like asking them their questions and giving them powers or roles and things like that. It's used as like a narrative thought bubble kind of device as well. And so you kind of just see the value of D&D in this, and that I think that Adventure Zone at least stands up to like if this is making no sense to you and D&D is a foreign concept to you, I think it's still a fun show to enjoy.
And it's three brothers and their dad.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Very cool. Okay, so Maddie Fox, we are abandoning the scary now, I think. But
yes.
All fantasy everything?
It is, yeah. It's a comedy podcast that's usually upwards of 2 hours. There's not a lot of podcasts I will listen to for more than about an hour, but this is the biggest exception. This is a podcast where a group of five comedians, will sit down and draft anything, like a fantasy draft for fantasy football, but for anything at all. So they've drafted Samuel L. Jackson movies. They've drafted one-hit wonders. They've drafted movie tropes. And so on October 11th of this year, they drafted autumnal, we'll say things, because the name wasn't quite appropriate for radio, but they talked about all the things about fall that they love the most. So if our other recommendations are creeping you out a little too much, you can turn to some comedy, because this was a great one that's still in the fall and Halloween-y mood.
What sets it apart maybe from other comedies? There are so many podcasts out there, and I'm interested in, you know, people who listen to a lot of them, for you to pick this one out of as your like one non-creepy thing. If you're going to recommend one right now, this is it. What is it about it?
Well, I like that it's the same. They kind of pull from the same rotating crew of panelists, and they have such a good rapport. These are people who are really good friends in real life, and they're all professional comedians, so they're funny. And they can bounce off each other really well. So on a good, like on a bad episode, if there was one, like I'm still chuckling a little bit. On a good episode, I have to pull over on the side of the road while I'm driving because I'm laughing so hard.
Well, so from one of our listeners on Twitter, we're getting one last spooky recommendation. We can't repeat the Twitter handle on the air, but for a scary podcast, this listener recommends The Mysterious Old Radio Listening Society, scary, spooky old radio shows like Lights Out and Inner Sanctum. For 70-year-old entertainment, it can hold up remarkably well. Have either of you heard of that?
No.
I have not, no.
But this seems to get back into that whole, like, an older style of storytelling that still somehow works.
Yeah, and I think, not to bring it back to Adventures in New America, but what they are doing there, and there's another podcast on Gimlet that's doing the same thing, is pushing diversity. And I think that that's what maybe radio drama needed to kind of bring into the fold.
Well, Mike Russo, Maddie Fox, thank you both so much.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
KCUR's Director of Marketing, Mike Russo, and Maddie is a reporter for Kansas News Service. Today, they've been the audiophiles. Up next on Central Standard, Frankenstein, or if you prefer, Frankenstein. I'm Gina Kaufman.
It's alive. It's alive. It's alive. It's alive. It's alive.
Frankenstein, the story, is turning 200 this year, and Dr. Frankenstein would surely be pleased to hear that it's still alive two centuries later. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And before we go, we're going to hear why this story and its themes never seem to die. My guest is Mitch Bryan, who hosted a talk on this very subject at the library last week. Hi, Mitch.
Hi, how are you?
Good. So you are a filmmaker. You teach film at UMKC, and you specialize in American horror. Is that right?
That is correct, yes.
Why do people continue to love Frankenstein?
I think it's because it has these themes that are timeless, you know, the themes of abandonment, of loss, of birth and death, And even this idea of the thing that is done that can't be undone, and all of the repercussions that come out of that. And so these are all themes that continue to resonate today, especially I think with, you know, she was 19 when she wrote it. And
Mary Shelley.
Yeah, Mary Shelley. And there are teenage angst aspects, you know.
Whoa, tell me about those.
Being abandoned by your parents or cast out into the world, and your own feelings of self-worth. And those are all the things that plague the monster when Frankenstein creates him and then instantly rejects him and just abandons him.
Aw.
I know, right? Aw, it's really sad. My son actually, when he came back from reading it in high school, decided that it should be called Frankenwein. Because everybody is just so woe is me. The doctor is woe is me. The monster is woe is me. It's very sad, the whole thing.
When I read it, I remember being most sort of intrigued by the take on what to me, I read it in the 1990s, felt like a take on technology.
Well, Brian Aldiss, the science fiction writer, claims that it's the first science fiction book because it is about a non-existing technology, i.e. the ability to bring life to the dead, that then propels us into this story that is as much about our world as a future world. So yeah, it's probably true.
And then this whole idea that if you can do it, you're going to.
Right, right. But I think the other thing
whether you should or not.
Whether you should or not. Mary Shelley said that was part and parcel of her initial conception when she was in Switzerland with Lord Byron and Percy Shelley, and they had this ghost story writing contest. And she dreamt this idea for Frankenstein. And in fact, she said in her diary that she says, "Frightful must it be, for supremely frightful would be the effect of any human endeavor to mock the stupendous mechanism of the creator of the world." So a man who dares to be like God.
So let's tell this, can you give like a 3-sentence synopsis of Frankenstein, the novel?
Yeah, it's divided into 3 parts. It's a ship's captain discovers in the Arctic this guy wandering around near death, and that's Victor Frankenstein, and he then tells him the story of how he sought to create life from the dead, brought a monster to life, rejected that monster, and then re-encounters the creature years later, and the creature has learned how to speak, and the creature sets out to pretty much destroy Frankenstein's life unless he creates a mate for him. And when Frankenstein decides not to create a mate for him, the monster destroys his family, his best friend, his wife, and everything.
So there have been a gazillion movie versions of this and several theater reenactments, and you know what? Have been many adaptations.
Many. Yeah.
As you look at the different movies and the different plays and the different adaptations of all forms, like comics, I mean, this cartoons. Is there something that you see as sort of the way that the themes translate from one time period to another being different?
Well, you know, when they made the first plays of Frankenstein in 1823, there were 5 different productions of Frankenstein happening around London, and one of them was a comedy. So even then, they recognized there's, you know, you're always with horror, there's always one step away from being funny, or sometimes it's mingled beautifully, like in James Whale's The Bride of Frankenstein, which is maybe the best Frankenstein movie of all.
Oh, no, that's Young Frankenstein.
Well, then there's Young Frankenstein, which is straight up comedy, which uses all of the original equipment from the original 1931 Frankenstein movie. So it's a very loving homage to it, as well as being a satire.
What are some of your favorite moments to see portrayed in cinema?
From Frankenstein?
Yes.
I think that idea of the monster stumbling into the hut of the blind guy who doesn't recognize his ugliness.
Tell it like someone's never seen it.
Well, I mean, the monster has been turned loose, is wandering in the forest, has nowhere to go, and comes upon this hut, and he seeks shelter, and there's a blind man in the hut who does not recognize his monstrous face, right? So he sees him for who he is. He teaches him how to speak. And in the movie, he teaches him how to smoke cigars. And this really sweet relationship forms between the two of them. And then the monster hides when the blind guy's kids come to stay with him. And he becomes this, you know, this mysterious gifter of things to the people in the house. And it's really sweet. It's really poignant. And I think that becomes, it's in Bride of Frankenstein. It's in Frankenstein, A True Story. And then, of course, in Young Frankenstein, they send it up beautifully with Gene Hackman being the blind hermit.
I think Gene Wilder.
Gene Hackman is Dr. Frankenstein.
Okay, yeah. And so I want to say about Young Frankenstein, the 1931 movie, the novel, everything. When you say Frankenstein to me, that is what I am picturing, is the Gene Wilder as Herr Frankenstein.
Yeah.
And this just sort of absurd send-up. Why is horror so funny? And why is that send-up so funny? I mean, if I'm in a bad mood, I can watch that movie and it is destroyed.
Yeah. Well, I think that it functions on so many levels. On one level, it's this really loving homage to those universal horror films. Like I said, they use the actual equipment that was used in the 1930 film. It borrows heavily from Bride of Frankenstein and Son of Frankenstein. And so in that sense, if you know those movies, it's working as a beautiful satire. But it's just a funny comedy as well. It has just jokes that are just – that play beautifully. The whole Frankenstein thing, Igor versus Igor, you know, the – fact that he steals a brain that is labeled abnormal but thinks he steals the brain from someone called Abby Normal. So, I mean, it's just good old-fashioned Mel Brooks shtick, you know, all through.
So what is – at 200, you know, this is a story that's 200 years old, adapted a gazillion times. What do you think that the different characters in the story represent that holds up and is relatable, even though, as you've mentioned, I mean – the story is ludicrous, you know, mm-hmm. It's
fantastical.
Yeah, well, that's a nicer word for it.
Yes.
But why is it that people are still relating to characters in such an extreme tale?
I don't know whether it's just the text as it exists or the fact that the text has become this other thing, that it's become all these different film versions.
It's alive.
Become serial. It's alive, yeah. Because, you know, some of the things that we love most in the movies, like the laboratory with all the, you know, whirring special effects and all that, none of that's in the book. I mean, suddenly he's just created this thing, and you never know how Frankenstein does it. I mean, Mary Shelley plays very, very fast and loose with how all this stuff actually works. And, you know, the monster is 8 feet tall and has superhuman strength, and I don't know how Frankenstein managed to do that, and we certainly don't find out from the book. So there's all these spaces for inventiveness in various interpretations, whether they be comedic or serious.
Do you have a favorite Frankenstein?
Yeah, I actually like this thing called Frankenstein, the True Story, that was made in 1973, and it's a pretty loose version of it, but it has all these wonderful ideas. It takes all the themes and really does do amazing things with them.
Such as?
Well, the fact that the female monster is actually created, because in the book, you know, Dr. Frankenstein sets out to create this female mate for the monster and then just can't go through with it and tears her up, which drives the monster crazy. In Frankenstein, the True Story, she is brought to life, like in The Bride of Frankenstein, but she bears the head of this girl that was the daughter of the blind man that is killed in a tragic accident, and the monster takes her and wants this head put onto that body so she becomes somebody else. So it's those weird inversions that make it so creepy and strange.
What do you think about the fact that so many people think that the monster's name is Frankenstein?
I don't know how that came to be. I really don't. I have no idea.
Does it bother you or are you okay with it?
It doesn't bother me.
Good. Okay. Now that we've got that out of the
yeah,
way.
Exactly.
Why do you think people enjoy being scared? I mean, this is veering away from Frankenstein in specific a little bit, but you are someone who does study the horror genre. Why would such a genre even exist that people would watch voluntarily things that frighten them?
Well, it's safe for a start. It's a safe way to confront fears. It's a safe way to be afraid, because we are all afraid. And if you can control that and be in a space where you can experience that fear and maybe realize that it's okay to be afraid, that maybe it's even fun to be afraid. That certainly makes life better in those instances where real fear manifests itself and we have to confront it. So I think that's the thrill of fear is a major factor.
But so that's interesting to me that you almost like the setting for watching a horror movie would really be like the safest setting, like your couch at home under a blanket with some popcorn. That's ideal. Like out in the woods, some sort of like outdoor screening in an unknown place. That might not feel like the
safe. As safe. Right. So then you get to decide how far you want to push these boundaries of being scared, right? They just screened The Descent, which is this horror movie set in a cave, in an actual cave setting last week. So that must have made it a little extra creepy, you know, to be in that environment.
And then when we look at Frankenstein, there's obviously like the character of the monster. Can you define a monster?
No, I can't, because I think we all have different ideas of what is monstrous. But if you think about the Frankenstein monster and his, you know, his sort of terrifying visage, his face that's been stitched together and it's grotesque. And you, then you think about a movie like I Was a Teenage Frankenstein. It's essentially dealing with these ideas of puberty, and suddenly I've got spots all over my face and I've got hair growing in strange places and I'm feeling monstrous. I don't feel like I was before, you know? And so those anxieties find their way into this tale.
When you think about your expertise, and you mentioned earlier that this was maybe like the first example of science fiction. What are some of the foundational ideas or like tropes in Mary Shelley's Frankenstein that make you think this is the basis for this entire genre?
That's a really great question. Well, Stephen King once wrote in Dance Macabre, this book that he wrote about the horror genre, that there are three kinds of fear, and they're horror, terror, and the gross out. And terrifying is the finest of the senses. Terrifying is the knock at the door and you open the door and there's no one there and you close the door and the knock comes back again. Horror is that which is sort of coming at you directly, and there's dread and fear involved with that. And then finally is the gross out, which is that, you know, something that revolts us. And Frankenstein has all of those elements in them, you know, the lurking dread of what this thing is going to do, who's out there and you don't know where he is and what kind of havoc he's going to cause, the revulsion of looking at the monster, and the sheer terror of its ability to, you know, attack and destroy.
You've said that one of the things that makes Mary Shelley's Frankenstein so relevant today is some feminism in the story, which I read it a long time ago. I'm curious where you see that in this story.
Well, I think that feminism, from the point of view that Mary Shelley herself was interested in breaking boundaries, breaking taboos, breaking structures that had been built into the system. She was a free-thinking, free-living sort of person. And I think that it also has a lot to do, on some level, it resonates with ideas about childbirth and, you know, the fact that there's an ambivalence about childbirth. And in the 1800s, if you were a woman, you knew you had a decent chance of dying while giving birth to a child. Mary Shelley's mother died giving birth to Mary. Mary had several children who didn't live. So there's that ambivalence and this question of responsibility, of choice, of agency, you know, and I think that all builds, it sort of has a feminist framework at the center of it.
Have you seen an adaptation that really delves into that analogy between the reanimation of this monster and childbirth?
Yeah, and the absolute best version is a book called The Diary of Elizabeth Frankenstein by Theodore Roszak, where he tells the entire story from Elizabeth's point of view, and it's absolutely great. So he's an amazing author, and it's one of his best books.
What about the bioethics piece of this? Because that brings us back to the question I was asking before about humankind daring to take on that which, you know, the natural world has already done in its own way, and what lines do we not cross?
Yeah, and that is completely and totally what Frankenstein is about. And so those bioethical concerns that exist now are completely apparent in Frankenstein and in this choice of the thing that we do which cannot be undone.
Are there contemporary versions that you have made you think differently about some of our contemporary bioethics questions, like things like genetics? And genetics would be a big one. I mean, we have the code for life on some level.
Yeah. Well, then that's the elasticity of a property like Frankenstein that's in the public domain. Anybody can take Frankenstein and build on it. And as an archetypical story of the creation gone awry, that finds its way into all sorts of science fiction stories that have nothing to do with Frankenstein except thematically, you know, on that level. And you hear somebody say, oh, this science fiction movie is a Frankenstein story.
What is the scariest movie you've ever seen?
That's a really good question. The first movie that scared me was The Mummy, the old Boris Karloff film. But I don't know what's the scariest movie. There are so many.
Maybe your first scare is your worst scare.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, you heard it here first, The Mummy. Thank you so much, Mitch Bryan.
Thank you for having me.
Mitch is a film professor at UMKC, and if you don't have trick-or-treating plans and you're feeling inspired to watch Frankenstein, the Tivoli is showing the Danny Boyle version tonight. You can go to tivolikc.com for the details. That's a wrap for our Halloween show. Go to kcur.org/centralstandard if there's anything you missed or want to hear again. kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, we're going to learn about circadian rhythms because we are about to have them severely messed with for daylight savings. You can talk to us on Twitter before then if you want. We're at KCURCST and I'm at Gina KCUR. This show, KCUR Central Standard, is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Sophia Gillespie. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to date is next. Boo.